you know, this is my ancestral home. And, you know, my grandmother was born and raised here. My family, her grandmother moved here from Alabama to Buxton, Iowa. And the stories of Buxton are really a town ahead of its time, where blacks and whites went into mines together, carving from the earth coal that energized this region. And I owe this state a lot of debt. You know, it really was a state that ushered my family out of poverty in the South into the working class. And from my grandmother's parents, who were right here in Des Moines, they were janitors and domestics, and got their kid off to college. A black woman from Des Moines, who his church took a collection right here in Des Moines, took a collection for her to get her off to Arkansas Pine Bluff, where she met my grandfather. So in many ways, my roots grow deep here, and it's a state that I really want to try to connect with. And so I'm determined to win, and it's the only way I know how to play. As a former football player in college, you don't show up on that field hoping to place. You show up saying you're going to play hard, work hard on the field, and aim to win the game.
What's your first Iowa memory?
I think I have just good memories as a little kid coming through, but there is my sort of best Iowa memories was a family reunion that we had, and I cannot tell you what it means to me to have one of the matriarchs of the family, my grandmother's first cousin, one of her closest friends that she had a singing group in. They opened for Cab Calloway and a lot of great jazz artists when they came through. So that love of my Aunt Alma, who turns 100 this month, is something that I really remember in that family reunion. And her, you know, I came from a family that saw things in me that I didn't see in myself, you know, that believed I had promise, and getting that kind of nurturing soil. When a child is believed in and loved, I think there's no limit to what they can't do.
You, when I believe President Trump tweeted at you, said you can't meet darkness with darkness. And
yeah.
You talked about the past day about having a positive message. There are many in your party who want people to go after the president, hammer Tom. How do you navigate that as a candidate?
I hope people really take time to see how I came up in politics. I came up through the toughest of political environments. In fact, there's an Oscar-nominated documentary you can watch on Netflix called Street Fight, where, you know, people will see that I had to stand in the saddle and fight the most vicious machine politics in America. But I didn't surrender my dignity. I didn't surrender my belief that to be strong, you don't have to be mean. To be tough, you don't have to be cruel. That there is a strength in this country of that lifts people up, that doesn't put people down. And that if you focus on that, that's what people are actually yearning for. And the culture of our politics is in a really bad place. You turn on the 24-hour cable stations and it is wall-to-wall about the president. And some of them want to paint him as Darth Vader, and some of them want to paint him as Luke Skywalker, but they're talking about him. And to me, we've lost our focus. It's not about him. It's about us. It's about the country. It's about the people. And I don't want to have an election. I don't want to be my president. And as I said, as an athlete, I want to win the election. But this is about more than an election. We're at a crossroads in the country. This is about a larger campaign for the very soul of our nation. And we're a nation that started with terrible inequities, and women didn't have the right to vote. Native Americans in our Declaration of Independence are referred to as savages. But our founders, the imperfect geniuses, did get something right. They knew that if we were going to make it in a country that's not bounded together by the same religion or the same race or the same sort of geographic origins, we were founded together because we broke with the course of human events to found a country on ideas that were bigger than the people that put them on paper. And they understood that if we were going to make it, we had to, as they say, the end of the Declaration of Independence is a declaration of interdependence. They said, we got to be there for each other. They use pretty big words, say that we have to pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Turn on the TV sometime and listen to how we talk about each other. Is that pledging sacred honor? Or is that trash-talking, trolling, demeaning, and degrading behavior? Now, I know who we are because my family came from folk who didn't look like us, sometimes didn't pray for us, who were willing to sacrifice their lives, literally. People like Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner, the three people from Mississippi Burning, who died together for voting rights, black, white, Christian, Jewish, standing together. I don't think when they stormed beaches in Normandy, they looked to their left and said, hey, you Republican or Democrat? They stood together. So I'm going to run a campaign the way I want to lead. And if my campaign is all about trying to trash Republicans and tear down folks that millions of people voted for, I don't think I'm contributing to this country in the way that I want to. Yeah, I want to win this election. I want to beat the Republican nominee, but I'm not running to beat people. I'm running to unite people and to unite this nation.
Issues.
Please.
First, Medicare for all. You're in the insurance capital of America. So what would happen to all these jobs?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of ways to get even to Medicare for all. And let's go on the biggest extreme. Let's go to a country that has universal, publicly provided health care. There's roles even in those countries for private insurers. And so let's just start where our common values are, because you're going to hear me say all throughout this campaign, we have common values and we have common pain. We need to get back to a sense of common purpose to address that pain and affirm our values. And so our common values are very simple. In this country, Republican, Democrat, Independent, everybody knows that you should not be in a situation when you work hard at your job where suddenly you have to put aside life-saving medication because you can't afford it. That a mom who's going to have a baby in a country where we say all men and women are created equal, well, that poor mother can't get her prenatal care until she shows up in the emergency room. We just don't believe those things as Americans. So let's just start with an idea in the richest country on the planet Earth that we believe healthcare is a right, that everybody should have quality, affordable healthcare. If we can all agree on that, there are so many things that we can do to get to the end that I want to see, which is everybody having access. There are things that we came close to doing in the Senate that somehow failed, and I think it was a failure of leadership. One of the things is just to expand Medicare to include up to 55-year-olds. You know what that would do if we did that today? First of all, it would take us middle-aged guys and others out of the public pool, of the private markets, into Medicare, and it would make those public markets have healthier people. What would happen to premiums and costs for the average person? They would go down. If we as a party first start talking about affordability, that there are common sense things we can do that dramatically drive down your prescription drug costs, to dramatically drive down your coverage, that's a beginning, and that begins to build public trust on a pathway to get to where we must go as a country, where everybody has health care.
John Kerry talked about that idea in 2003, having, you know, 50-year-olds, 55-year-olds buy into Medicare. What makes you think that the country is ready for that? It hasn't been heretofore.
I think because everywhere I've gone, from the Great Lakes to the Gulf Coast, from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific, I have not had a public forum where somebody has not told me god-awful stories about their family and their experiences with trying to get health care. Hurtful, painful stories. Middle-class families, working-class families. What's going on in America is cruel. We have a system that is cold and cruel, and there is an urgency now to fix these problems. And I believe I can talk to the hearts of Republicans and Democrats and those people that want to demonize things and try to say, oh, socialism and all these things to try to take the wind out of common sense solutions. I believe now we can build a consensus to get us farther down the road towards universal access to health care than we are now. And it's a quite crisis of leadership. And again, I think the kind of leadership that gets us there is the kind of leadership that can find common ground, pull people together to get things done.
Green New Deal, you're getting questions about that. I believe that was the very first question that was asked in Mason City.
Yeah, I love this. We've gone from a nation where you have a president that stands up and says, look at the moon. It's no longer going to be a dream. It's going to be a destination. You didn't then have a whole bunch of people saying, wait a minute, how are you going to pay for that? That's outlandish. We need to be doing this. Are you going to raise my taxes? No. We got energized and excited that America would lead the planet Earth, lead humanity to the moon. And now we have not only a calling, but a crisis from the fires in the West, the flooding in the Midwest, sea level rising and storms that are bashing New Jersey. We have an urgency right now. And other countries, by the way, our competitors, China, making massive investments in green technology because they want to lead in the 21st century on the industries of tomorrow. No, we are America. Let's get our swagger back. There's a crisis on the planet Earth, like in the past with the Marshall Plan, defeating the Nazis. We ran to lead this planet to better places. I want that kind of bold leadership. And so this idea that the naysayers and the negativity that somehow you can't get there without hurting Americans, that's just wrong. I'm a mayor. I had to run things and fix things. I showed my city, hey, you know what? We're going to environmentally retrofit our city buildings. Yeah, it's going to take some money up front, but you know what it's all going to do? Lower our energy costs. And guess what I'm going to do as we retrofit those buildings? I'm going to employ Newark youth to get those done. So we got jobs, lower energy costs. And guess what's going to happen as well? Oh, we are going to be a city that, as a result of those two things, that's going to create a healthier environment for everybody. So I'm saving taxpayer dollars. I'm putting people to work. I'm greening our city. That's the kind of things that can actually get it done. And so we need to start to understand that there is an urgency for us to lead again. And we shouldn't tear down people that have bold visions. We should think to ourselves, how can we come together and make them a reality?
You talked about corporate agriculture in Mason City as well. As president, would you have a Department of Justice that would more adequately review proposed mergers in the agribusiness sector?
So I put in legislation to put a moratorium on these corporate mergers. And it came from after going into the Midwest and sitting with farmers, Republicans and Democrats, and listening to their stories about what's happened to their culture, to the heritage of this country, and how different farming is from their grandfathers and their fathers' age when they had 5 and 6 people to sell their goods to, or the source materials when they had much more competition in the seed sector and others.
So Bayer-Monsanto merger?
No way. I mean, how could we have not scrutinized that better? And what those companies are doing, I mean, the best way to give this an example is, and this is why I think the illusion of separateness in our country is very dangerous, to think that my folks who live, my neighbors in Newark, New Jersey, aren't connected to the farmers. The consumers and the producers, they should be far more aligned in this as the people who are unjustly profiteering. So that consumer dollar that my residents spend in Newark, New Jersey, when they go to the supermarket that we brought to the city to deal with our food deserts, they are getting so much less of a share, 40, 50% less than their parents and grandparents did, because they're getting squeezed by all this corporate consolidation. And that's why I get disturbed when our politicians want to try to pit our farmers against consumers or one part of this country against another part of the country. We are all in this together. We have a lot of common pain, and we each other are not the enemy. It's this change we've seen in corporate culture. We did an interview. We looked at studies where they interviewed corporate CFOs and said, given the new corporate culture in this country, have you ever made decisions that were against the long-term interest of your company in order to meet those quarterly profit earnings? Over 80% said, yes, I have. So we've created this pernicious corporate culture that is hurting long-term growth, hurting wage growth, and definitely hurting farmers and consumers. And we've let this spin out of control since the 1980s. It's not just Donald Trump. We all got to stop pointing fingers and start accepting responsibility that the economy here is very different than the economy when my dad was coming up. That when you worked a full-time job, even if you were making minimum wage in those days, you were above the poverty line. We've got to get back to work with dignity, whether you are farming the land, whether you are a home health aide, whether you are cleaning airplanes at Newark Airport. We've got to get back to a point where everybody is not getting, frankly, screwed by a radically transformed, now predatory corporate culture, but that we've got businesses and communities and producers and consumers all benefiting from a more moral economy.
What's your view on U.S. trade policy and the unilateral pacts, or would you prefer bilateral?
So first of all, this is one of the times we have to admit that the critics on both sides of the aisle are right. We allow trade and trade policy to hurt people. And there are folks in this country, including New Jersey, who look at what happened over the previous decades as we rushed to embrace so-called globalism and left so many people out, left so many people behind. And so I think we just can't allow that to happen anymore. We are moving into a 21st century economy, and we've also got to admit that 25% or more of the jobs that exist right now won't even exist in the latter part of this century, in the coming decades. There are whole industries that are going to transform the transportation sector. What's that going to mean when we electrify, when we have driverless cars? What's that going to mean to farmers? What's that going to mean to truck drivers? If we leave those people behind, shame on us, and politicians should suffer as a result of that. And so when it comes to trade, look, we can't retreat from the planet Earth. We just can't. And we've got to start talking about America leading through our international organizations, whether that's NATO or global climate pacts. And yeah, there's a role for the United States to be involved in trade. There's foreign policy and national security roles. China is out there out-competing us. I flew into Zimbabwe and to meet with Mugabe's successor to try to get them, me and Jeff Flake, a Republican, to try to make sure that he holds free and fair elections. So democratic principles are exalted. And guess what? Mnangagwa, the new leader, had just flown back from China, where they told him, we don't care what you do, subjugating your people, being a dictator. We're just here for your natural resources because we're in a global competition against Western democracy. So we're competing with China. And if we cede the Asian markets to them and let their economy grow at the expense of ours, let their influence in that region grow at the expense of ours, we're going to find ourselves 30, 40 years shut out and them having more dominance.
So would you revive TPP?
I didn't like TPP where it had landed, especially how it, I thought, really put American workers in a bad place. But to revive the TPP talks and do it the right way, have fair trade and smart trade, heck yeah, I'm going to run straight at that problem.
What about voting for USMCA, NAFTA 2.0?
Again, I want to study the details. I have a lot of concerns about it. You know, just think of something called trade adjustment help. I mean, most people want to talk about racing towards this trade, but still not doing something. The kind of significant things it would really help the American worker. So don't talk to me about NAFTA 2.0 or 3.0 when we know NAFTA 1.0 hurt so many people. Talk to me what your plan is first and foremost. Come to me with your plan for the American worker. Whether you campaigned on that, I saw people standing in front of factories and the like, and now those factories are still closing. What is your plan for an American worker before you come to me and start talking to me about racing towards another trade deal that leaves them out?
Another issue, top tax rate.
There's not a, again, this is where there's so much common ground. We are a nation that has stopped investing in us, in our infrastructure, in our education, in our research and development. And a lot of the reason we stopped is because we're running historic deficits. And what we seem to think that's going to solve these deficits is continuing to lower the tax rates on the wealthiest Americans and the wealthiest corporations. Let's give them more and more tax breaks. And by the way, when you cut your revenue into your business, into your family's earnings, you create shortfalls. And that's where we are in America right now. We're the first generation of Americans. My grandmother here in Iowa told me stories about when we went to war, everybody sacrificed. You had victory gardens, rationing. My grandfather worked on a bomber plant, Willow Run. There was this pride. We're the first generation of Americans that has a war. We've been at it for 17 years, spending trillions of dollars. And guess what the Republican president did? Said, guess what? We're going to war, and I'm going to give you a tax break. We're not going to pay for this. We've been so fiscally irresponsible. And those tax breaks didn't really help the middle class. They helped the wealthiest to grow even wealthier. So we need to raise marginal tax rates at the wealthiest. We need to take our corporate tax rates and make them work to incentivize what we really need in this country. Raise the corporate tax rates to 25, 26%. If we just raise them, we create so much more revenue. Some of that we can use for tax breaks for the businesses that need it. Small businesses that don't have all those corporate tax loopholes that the big boys use. These small people who are risking their own capital, who are struggling to get bank loans. Those are the folks that need tax breaks, not the GE and companies like that whose effective tax rate is zero, that use all of those loopholes. Let's close that corporate welfare, get that resources, reinvest in education, reinvest in infrastructure, reinvest in the things that will grow our economy and help us compete with the Chinese.
If you are the party's nominee and you're on a debate stage with President Trump, how will you respond when he shoots a nickname at you? the Spartacus nickname seems to be embraced by your Republican friends?
Well, first of all, we don't even know if Donald Trump is going to be the nominee. He's got some rocky roads ahead of him. And I've worked across the aisle with Lindsey Graham to protect the Mueller investigation. And as we see everybody around him being indicted, some of them pleading guilty, there's a whole lot of smoke going on here. So I don't know who the Republican nominee is going to be, but I learned in track as a high school student, don't focus on the people your left or your right, run your race. And so whoever the Republican nominee for president is, it's not about them, it's about the American people. And I'm going to bring a message that I want to embody, which is that in our politics, we need less trolling and trash talking and toxicity, and we need more decency and grace. I believe the American people don't want to see how well I can fling mud back at somebody who's flinging mud at me, and everybody in America then gets dirty or at least feels just like they need a shower after watching our political dialogue. I want to elevate our country. I want to let everybody know that we can rise together to deal with our common problems, and we're not going to deal with them if I campaign in a way that the 40 million Americans, 50, 60 million Americans that might still vote for that Republican candidate if I trash them along with it. And so, people might not think it's a winning strategy. I'm at one of the higher offices in the land by operating this way in lots of very tough elections. I'm running this election to try to get us back to the ideals and the values that got my family out of poverty, which is people that were intent on creating a more beloved community, that even though you're different than me, we're in this together. And that's the kind of rhetoric and the kind of spirit I'm bringing to this campaign.
On Twitter, Pat Reinert wondered if you have enough relatives in Iowa to have one vote in every precinct.
I'm proud to have Iowa family, but I'm coming to this state, and nobody will outwork me. I'm going to crisscross the state. I'm a former mayor. The only way you win a mayor's race with hundreds of thousands of people in my city is by going out and working to earn people's respect and to earn people's vote. There are family members that I still have to go to because they take this seriously. They may love me and want to see the best for me, but they're holding their votes for the people that they think can best not just win an election, but heal our country. And so I'm going to crisscross the state, work harder, run longer hours. Last night, my head hit the pillow at 3 a.m. I had started that day at around 6, 7 a.m. And when I'm here, I'm coming to share my heart and connect with folk.
Some of the past competitors have not embraced the caucus process, if you will, or didn't even understand it. What sort of knowledge do you bring to that, and how do you think your candidacy fits in that sort of structure?
Well, for all the people outside of Iowa that want to criticize this process, the intention is to democratize, to create a fairness in this state, so that the rural areas aren't ignored by a bunch of outside politicians that come in and just want to campaign in the big cities. It's this idea that everyone matters. It's this idea that the voices of every Iowan, whether you live in a small county with just a few thousand people, or you live in a big city with hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands. And I think there's some wisdom in that. And actually, it benefits the whole country. People should know how I do in a suburb, know how I do in a rural area, know how I do in a city, that I can talk to an immigrant community, people from the Sudan, and talk to their issues as well as I can talk to that family farmer who's been on their land since the 1800s. And so I'm excited by the challenge. I think it's actually a good process. It demands a lot, but I'm again a person that has come through physically grueling things. You try to do three a days in the hot August sun with 20 pounds of pads on. I'm up for the physical test, but the spiritual test is really what I'm excited about. Will we take shortcuts in our politics to throw raw meat out there, to bash people, to drag down folks in order to try to elevate yourself? Or we will take the more difficult road in politics by talking to people's hopes and dreams, not their fears? Will we be talking to people's aspirations? Will we be talking to people about coming together, not slicing and dividing and triangulating just to win a short-term election, but lose a larger campaign for our country?
Have you talked to Bill Bradley about this? I covered his campaign in 1999, and he didn't get it. He ran up the score in the urban areas, but did very poorly in rural Iowa.
So Bill's a mentor, and he gave me some of the best advice before I went to the United States Senate, where he said to me, Corey, try to have dinner or meet with every one of your Republican colleagues. And because of him, I tried. I went out to dinner with Ted Cruz. I go to prayer, a Bible study with Chairman Inhofe. And what ended up happening is it's very hard to hate somebody you've broke bread with. It's hard to demonize. You actually learn about their family. I know Ted Cruz. I know his wife. She's a vegetarian, which I often tease at Texas Cattlemen about. And it actually helped me get things passed. I had a bill, an amendment to an education bill for foster kids and homeless kids. My staff even told me, Lamar Alexander was managing the bill. You can't get anything on this bill. He's not letting any amendments. And I went to work. I went to Chairman Inhofe, and I made this appeal about how foster kids and homeless youth are being left out. And he looked at me, a man I had prayed with, a man I've gotten to know, and he said, "Do you really want this?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he goes, "I'm going to co-sponsor your amendment." Suddenly, I had a chairman of a committee co-sponsoring an amendment. We got just enough Republican votes to now create it as the law of the land. And so Bill Bradley has the right spirit, and he's been an advisor. When it comes to winning in Iowa, the best people I've learned to trust, though, are Iowans who have a lot of experience, a lot of knowledge about how to do well here.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.